Sweet Mother Michigan, Father Superior, coming down from Mackinac and Sault Ste. Marie. Blue water Huron rolls down to Lake Erie, falls into Ontario and runs on out to sea.
Welcome to the maiden voyage of Voices of the Great Lakes podcast. I'm your host, Caleb Ford. Today, I welcome to the show the preeminent musical voice and raconteur of the Great Lakes Maritime World, Mr. Lee Murdoch. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today. It's an honor, sir.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
Thanks so much. So, I was reading through your website. I recently discovered your music and was completely taken with not only the songs themselves, but the sheer body of your work. it's really impressive. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe you have something like 24 albums. Is that right?
Yeah, it's something like that. After a while, you kind of lose track, but it's around 24. Yeah.
Great. So I guess that kind of begs the question then. This is a two-parter, but how did you get into telling these stories about the Great Lakes and really delving deep into the history and making these, the voices really you're a perfect guest for Voices of the Great Lakes. It seems that you really dedicate a lot of time and effort to uncovering the voices and stories of sailors and fishermen, many marginal figures as well, in the history of the Great Lakes. Put another way, what compels someone to, dedicate such a large part of their creative output and their life really to preserving and communicating the stories of the Great Lakes maritime world through songs?
It basically is happenstance in some regards. Well, I graduated college in 1975 at Drake University. And at that time, I was playing some popular music and folk music and stuff like that. But I always, ever since I was young, I loved stories and story songs, as most people do. But and a lot of the pop music didn't really have stories in it, but the folk music did. And so I gravitated towards the folk music just in what I was listening to. But also, I was infatuated with the sound of the acoustic steel string guitar. The fact that you could put something on your knee and just play it and not have to plug in and do all different types of pedals and stuff was just fascinating to me. And I just loved it. So I got my degree in earth science and was going to go into geology as a PhD, going to go in a PhD program, probably at Montana State. And my interest was not in getting a degree to work for an oil company or a mining company. My interest was in, get this, continental glaciation. A lot of jobs on that, folks, not much. But I would be able to teach and that type of thing. But then my then girlfriend and now wife and partner, Joanne, said, well, why don't you try it in folk music a little bit? So I came back from Iowa into Chicago to start a career in folk music, got a job, but then started singing the folk clubs. And at that time, what I sang was all different types of folk songs, the blues, ragtime music, songs of the sea, Midwestern songs, protest songs, Irish songs, songs from the British Isles, all those types of things, because I was just fascinated with the cowboy songs. And all through the 80s, when I decided to do this as my livelihood in 1980, that was kind of what I billed myself as, a pretty instrumental guitarist and singer. And I would talk about the songs. So I know this is a little bit roundabout, but it sets the stage for the decision that happened upon me when in 1989, I put out an album called Fertile Ground, which had like six Great Lakes songs on it. But it didn't have much in the way of graphics as far as that is concerned. And I approached a maritime museum to see if they could sell this CD in their gift shop. And they said, well, it doesn't really look like anything that we would be able to sell, even though the material inside of it was strongly Great Lakes material. So I thought, well, why not? I'll just do my next album will just be all Great Lakes material. And kind of the rest is history, because I had enough material for that album, Cold Winds. And then a couple years later, I had enough material for another album, Safe in the Harbor, and then another album, Freshwater Highway, and they just built on itself. And what was interesting about this was it wasn't, like you say, it wasn't just the songs. It was the background of the songs, the in-depth. See, I grew up in Chicago area without really a clue as to the role that the Great Lakes played, even though, you know, 100 years before I was born, Chicago was one of the main ports, not just in the United States, but in the entire world. And so I just didn't have a clue. And when I came across these songs, originally from books like Folk Songs of North America. In fact, I think I even have a copy of that here, right here. This is a great book by Alan Lomax, okay? Folk Songs of North America. And the first song that I learned out of this was a song called The Red Iron Ore. But then I came across this collection that was compiled by a fellow named Ivan Walton. He was a professor of English at the University of Michigan in the engineering school. And he went and collected songs from sailors that had, when they were young, they were on the windjammers. They were on the schooners on the Great Lakes. And there was this whole singing tradition and story tradition, ballad tradition that they incorporated with. And some of it was just because of their singing their history, but also part of it was back in those days, if you were in a tavern and you had a Great Lakes song, you got a free drink. Okay. So that was the mother of invention on some of this stuff. And
carry on that tradition.
That's right. But and so that is what really made it fascinating for me to get into this world that really has been a source of great inspiration for 40 years, something like that.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's so interesting. So really, you know, based on your story and the way you seem to approach music, you're obviously an accomplished musician, but right, you're also almost as much an ethnomusicologist or a scholar, a historian of sorts, right? And, you know, doing your part to sort of dig up these stories. So as a musician and a historian myself, I'm really curious about your process, not only your songwriting process, but also your, you know, how you research these topics, what sorts of sources you use. Obviously, I can see your library back there.
We got a few books.
Quite read, yes, quite well read, and your background in academia and all that. But I'm really curious, you know, what sorts of sources do you use? Are there particular libraries or archives that have been especially helpful in your journey in uncovering these things? Another question would be, for those historians and people seeking to do research on the history of the Great Lakes, do you have any advice as far as treasure troves of sources or places or even people that you recommend for uncovering Great Lakes history?
Well, I'm indebted to a lot of the historians and educators. When I started doing this, I kind of felt like it's important to be interact with the next generation. And so I did a lot of programs in schools, and it was actually Folk Songs of the Great Lakes region. That's what I did. And I started doing that originally back in the mid 80s with the Philadelphia Folk Song Society, because what they had was they had this big folk festival every year, but that folk festival sponsored events throughout the year into the community, whether it was a service organization or whether it was schools or that type of thing, church groups. And so they brought me in for their Odyssey program. And I went and I did a number of schools for them and singing about where I was from, you know, that type of thing. And so the folk organizations that have supported me over the years, like Wheatland Organization in Michigan, Philadelphia Folk Song Society, Fox Valley Folklore Society here in the Chicago area, the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, and countless others, Iowa Public Radio out in Iowa, they've all supported my work in that regard, getting it to the public. And that's a very important aspect of the message that we have. But also the historians, the people who are the museum curators at Dawson Great Lakes Museum, or up at the Shipwreck Museum in Whitefish Point up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, or the Erie Maritime Museum in Erie, Pennsylvania, all these different places, Mystic Seaport in Mystic, Connecticut. All these places are fabulous sources of information and inspiration. So that's where the story and substance comes from. Now, the musical aspect of it, it's a little bit involved. It's, I'm self-taught musician, okay? So like when I was very young, I could sing songs and stuff like that by memory, and didn't really learn how to read music at an early age, but I picked up the guitar about 11 and a half, when I was about 11 and a half, 12 years old, and I played pop music and Beatles songs, all different types of things. And I played by ear. Okay. And so because at my early part of the career, when I was doing all different types of music, that influenced my musical experiences as well. So you had some calypso music or some blues or a traditional ballad, where you would just sing last Saturday morning, the horns did it blow from the green hills round Tassau, the huntsmen did go to meet the bold sportsmen from round Katy Town, and it was her last sight from the boys of Maydown. That's a song called The Grainmore Hare, which is from Ireland and Scotland. And so though it was a broad range of music that I can use as the palette to tell the stories. And it's centered on the acoustic guitar, the steel string acoustic guitar. Yeah, I play classical guitar too, but my technique's not as good on the classical as on the steel string. It's a different thing. But and the musical inspirations, Pete Seeger, Burl Ives, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan, the Beatles, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Neil Young, and even into the present, Sting. Well, I guess that's not present. That's old, isn't it? The Police.
He's still touring.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And all different types of that music, up to, a more modern group like Mumford and Sons. What they're doing is they're incorporating the energy and experience of discovery and interfacing it with historic and emotional topics. And that's what drives me.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. That reinterpretation of the folk idiom, it's nice to see that that's alive and well in your music, as well as the music of younger artists. I guess another question that I'm curious about is, you've clearly dug up a lot of really interesting stories and things mm-hmm. like that. Are there any stories that particularly stand out in your mind that you feel were particularly powerful, that you said, hey, I feel compelled to make a song about this, or at least incorporate some aspect? I'm sure there's probably more than one. If you could just maybe share one of those stories that you've uncovered, and what I guess what was it about it that spoke to you and compelled you to incorporate it into your music?
Probably one of the most popular of my songs is a song called The Christmas Ship. Mm. And The Christmas Ship talks about a schooner that would come into Chicago with Christmas trees in the holiday season, and would sell trees directly from the vessel to people in Chicago. And in 1912, it was lost at sea. And the story that happened on it was in a book called The Great Lakes Reader by Walter Havockhurst, and it was a book, a story that was appeared in the Chicago Tribune, I think, in 1942 on the 30th anniversary of the loss of the vessel. And it was written by a fellow named Harry Hansen. And it basically told about this story. And I was intrigued with that. Also, there was another book by William Radigan, another journalist, but historian. And he put a book out in the late 50s called Shipwrecks and Survivals. And then it was updated with the advent of the loss of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I had that copy. And each chapter in that book had was centered on a lake. And so in Lake Michigan, there was subtitles in these parts of the chapter. And there was a subtitle that went, Christmas Trees for Davy Jones. And so I read that as well. Then about the same time, this is the late 80s, it's about 88, I came across a painter, an artist named Charles Vickery. And he had done a series of three paintings about the specific event. And I was kind of going like, man, this is quite a story. And my final source was a fellow who worked in the night decks and city desk at in the 30s and 40s. He basically gave me some of the fleshed out information about the story itself. So I was intrigued. I got it from four different sources, all roughly within, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 month period. Dornfeld was his name. And he was the fellow who coined the phrase to Mike Royko, who was a Cub reporter at the time, if your mother loves you, check it out. You know, this was that guy. And so, and he had quite a fascinating way of addressing people. And what I ended up doing was I looked at this loss of this vessel, not from the perspective of somebody aboard the vessel. I looked at it from the perspective of a person who was disappointed, a child who was disappointed at Christmas time.
In the time of my life that recollection often turns, the snow always fell knee deep, the iron wood stoves burned, the ever-present distant sound of jingling sleigh bells combined with the cadence of stock and trade into a wonderful swell. The creeping of the days never cautioned any fear. The hours spent on sleds and skates only slowly disappear. When a special day arrived, it came but once a year. When to the Clark Street Bridge we'd go, right down to the pier. Oh, Papa, come look. Oh, Mama, can you see? I've been waiting for so long for this to come to be. Oh, Papa, come look. Oh, Mama, can't you see? Here comes the Christmas ship with all
Christmas
the
Christmas trees. That gives you an idea of the way the story is, and it's that sets the stage. It goes through explaining how the trees were sold and when they would, what time of the year they would go up, and then the loss of the vessel and then the aftermath. And so that is probably one of the, of my particular songs, the historic songs that I wrote, was probably one of the ones that really kind of set me on the course to this genre of material.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah. So listening through your, well, putting, trying to put a dent in it, at least listening through your body of work the past few days, were a few songs that really struck me as particularly powerful. One of those songs is Safe in the Harbor, which is the title track to one of your 24 albums. Yeah. What's the story behind that? It's a really touching and captivating song.
It's a beautiful song. It's written by an Australian fellow named Eric Bogle. And Eric was a contemporary, you know, he was very popular, and he may still be popular for all I know. I'm kind of sequestered in my career, so I don't know what's going on as much in the folk world as I did, you know, 30 years ago. But He was a songwriter of note that would travel North America periodically. And he befriended a fellow named Stan Rogers. And Stan Rogers was a great, fabulous songwriter, Canadian songwriter, talking about, you know, Canadian maritimes and also the Canadian history and song. And I was lucky enough to get a chance to meet him. And I recorded one of his songs early on and was able to, you know, give him a copy of it and that type of thing. And in 1983, June, I believe, 2nd, Stan Rogers perished in an accident on an airplane, a fire. And so that whole summer, all the Canadian festivals were dedicated to Stan Rogers. Mm-hmm. And Eric wrote this song as a eulogy mm-hmm. to him, okay? And you're safe in the harbor now, so you've gone back home, that type of thing. Now, what is interesting about this, and it was very sad, and it was a lot of tears and emotion, and still, when I even think about it, there's kind of like this sad part in my heart, you know, for the loss of such a magnificent artist and person. But what I found was that, you know, it was a song, you know, this was probably 83. This was a song that was very, very sad. And of course, at that time I was doing a lot of work in bars, et cetera, like that. And you can't be singing a bunch of bad and sad songs at bars, you know, not till the end, at least. At the end, you can get all sad as you want because everybody's in that spot. But then a woman named Margaret Crystal recorded it a few years later. And I listened to it and I thought that was a really nice album. It was on a cassette. And if you know anything about the cassettes, I mean, I was an LP guy and then I liked the CDs. And cassettes were always fine, but they never had as much information as the LPs did, you know. And so there wasn't even any real background on this song. On the cassette. And so I was singing it at a club and sang the song, made my arrangement. And somebody said, well, that was the eulogy for Stan Rogers, which I had completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. And what in that transformation going from Eric's version to Margaret Crystal's version, and then to my version, it kind of lifted into a different spot. It's more like an homage to the sailors and those who want to be sailors or dream about being sailors and finding a safe harbor. And that's kind of the story behind that. And it's there's been a number of people that have wanted me to sing that song. A lot of times I'll finish my concerts with that song because it's kind of wraps everything up, you know, but not in a sad way as much now. It's more like uplifting now.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you say it was a eulogy for Stan Rogers, because as my partner and I were listening to it the other night while we were making dinner, I said, you know, this reminds me of Jimmy Buffett in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Passed away a few weeks ago, right?
I know, you know.
And we both kind of almost, you know, teared up just thinking about that. It seemed very fitting.
Right. Or David Crosby earlier this year. You know, it's like all these guys that are, you know, passing on. But, you know, that's kind of where we're at, you know. And it's up to us to nurture and inspire people along the way so that it keeps going, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the great thing about music, right? Once you put it out there in the ether, it just sort of, you know, goes on forever.
Really? That's the beauty of that.
It is. So I share with you one of my favorite songs, Safe in the Harbor. Do you have any particular favorites that you incorporate regularly into your set?
Probably a real popular one, and I enjoy singing it, is a song called The Great Lake Song. And that's was written by a person named Pat Daly with help with Shel Silverstein. Mm. And Pat Daly played at a place on Putin Bay, which is an island in Lake Erie, mm-hmm. where people go to forget, if you know what I mean. They go for the weekend and forget about everything. And right. so he would perform there. But he liked, I think it was a stint where he actually worked a little bit on some of the lake boats. And so he wrote with some authority about what it was like to be on the boats and the Great Lakes experience. And what was nice about that song, when I incorporated it, I learned it originally from another legendary songwriter and folk artist, a fellow named Bob Gibson, who was a pretty prominent folk singer in the late 50s. He was the one who introduced Joan Baez back in 1961 at Newport. So he was already established along the same line. He was actually predecessor to the Kingston Trio. And so he and I were doing some programs together, probably mid-80s or so. And he sang this song. He came up, because I was doing the Great Lakes stuff songs, and he said, you know, Lee, I do some Great Lakes songs too. And he played a couple of them. And this one that he played by Pat Daly and Shel Silverstein was like a overture to a whole program. So a lot of times, for a long time, and I still will do it on occasion, I'll start the whole concert out with that song, because it really encaptures the whole Great Lakes experience.
Sweet Mother Michigan, Father Superior, coming down from Mackinac and the Sault Ste. Marie. Blue water Huron rolls down to Lake Erie, falls into Ontario and runs out to sea. The Great Lakes are a diamond on the hand of North America, a bright shining jewel on that friendship border ring. It's a freshwater highway coming down from Canada, and all along the coastline you can hear the people sing. Sweet Mother Michigan, Father Superior, coming down from Mackinac and Sault Ste. Marie. Blue water Huron rolls down to Lake Erie, falls into Ontario and runs on out to sea.
Kind of gives you an idea how that it just really ties everything up and is a real nice beginning to a concert.
Absolutely. And I'll have to work out all the broadcast rights and things of that nature, but that would be a perfect theme song for our podcast here, I think.
Sure. That would be good.
Thank you. Yeah. And I invite all of our listeners today to check out Lee's music. Again, it's great stuff, great storytelling, and also just wonderful songs. It's really nice to just listen to musically and enjoy.
Thank you very much, Caleb.
Thank you, Lee. Let's turn to something a little lighthearted here as we we round the corner of the podcast. I wonder, so it's also clear from your music and from our conversation today, you're very well traveled in the region. And I know I spoke with your wife the other day, and she mentioned that you guys make it up to the UP, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, fairly often, maybe at least once a year if you can. That's a place near and dear to my heart, as I grew up spending, you know, many summers and a few winters occasionally growing up at my grandparents' cottage in the Upper Peninsula near Newberry and Paradise there in the east.
Oh, sure.
But I wonder, on your travels, is there any place that that you just really love, that you find yourself going back to, you know, time and again, and just, you know, kind of stays with you after you get home? Are there any favorite spots?
There are a lot of favorite spots. You know, it's I hate to be egalitarian, but I am. I mean, there's so many. Each one of the lakes have their own persona, have their own feel. You know, growing up near Lake Michigan, we kind of had that ethos of the, as they call it, the all-American lake. where, you know, when you're looking across the great expanse of Lake Michigan and looking east from Chicago or west from Michigan, you know, and you don't see anything but water, that's a pretty powerful image, you know, especially if you're here in the Midwest, where your horizon is usually defined by trees or prairie.
Mm.
And not like it is in, you know, Tennessee or Pennsylvania or Colorado, defined by mountains. And so that a large expanse of water is as profound as mountains are. And mm-hmm. and these lakes are as give you the same sense of vastness that looking out from the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean, even though they are astoundingly bigger, you get that same feel. Mm. And Lake Michigan has a different look than Lake Huron, than Lake Superior. So that said, there are, the western part of the UP is substantially different than the eastern part of the UP. Mm-hmm. Okay. Western, you have the Porcupine Mountains and a lot of igneous type rock and iron ore and copper as you get into the central UP, whereas you get on the eastern UP, it's much more like the Niagara Escarpment, you know, that type of geology. Of course, I'm going back to my geology and, you know, college, you know, that is the aspect that I find as far as the Upper Peninsula is concerned. Is that you have, when you go from the extreme east to the extreme west, it's like a complete geologic sea change. And that's just fascinating. And is it my favorite? Well, it's one of my favorites. It's a place that I can, in my memory, go and visit and enjoy.
Hmm.
Okay. Now the Lower Peninsula, Northern Lower Peninsula is beautiful. Actually, there are aspects of the Southern Lower Peninsula is beautiful too. Now, I know there's this kind of ethos that people in the Upper Peninsula, they refer to themselves as Upers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they refer to people in the Lower Peninsula as trolls because they're below the bridge. I prefer to use the term loper as opposed to troll. And it's that interplay between the two groups that also is an aspect of the Great Lakes experience. It's similar. Well, I was just in New York, you know, this last weekend, and there's a different ethos in New York than there is in Wisconsin.
Mm.
But it's because in New York State, there's an emphasis east, and Wisconsin, there's an emphasis north.
Mm-hmm.
So those are and every place, I know I'm kind of ducking the question, but every place has its beauty and I relish it. That's kind of what I live in.
Absolutely. Yeah, that brings to mind a couple of things. You know, I try to explain to people often about this idea of, and I assume, well, you mentioned Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. I don't know if Illinois is this way, but Michigan certainly is, this whole idea of up north, right? And what it means, it's not just a direction, right? Or it's not just a place, right? It's a state of mind, it's a feeling. Yes. And when you say up north, at least to another person from Southern Michigan, they know exactly what you mean, right? It evokes something almost magical, right? Yes. When you talk about going up north. And in particular, I think, you know, some people, I guess, up north snobs, as it were, for them, the up north doesn't really start until you cross the Mackinac Bridge, right? And into the UP.
Or further west, north doesn't really happen until you get north of Duluth.
Interesting.
You know, that's really up north. That's the true North Shore of Superior, you know.
Right. So I suppose up north is relative. Right?
It is. And of course, for people in Thunder Bay, up north is Churchill, Ontario, Churchill, Manitoba. I mean, right. Hudson's Bay, that's up north.
Right,
you know?
So,
but, you know, the beauty of that perspective, to be to even things out a little bit, there's a similar ethos. And you get to the southern part in southern Indiana, southern Ohio, southern Illinois, northern Kentucky. There's this whole Ohio River system. And Ohio is actually a Seneca word for beautiful river. And there's magnificent beauty in the Ohio Valley, as there is the Mississippi Valley. You can see I kind of like waterways, but and for those folks, it isn't necessarily up north. It's going to the mountains. It's going to the foothills.
Right.
And that's you know, so it's again going to this other place that has extreme and vibrant beauty. You know, there is, it had been a lot, many years because of my work was around the Great Lakes. I had been out to the Rocky Mountains for a long time. When I was a kid, we would go out periodically and, or to Pennsylvania and upstate New York to the, or down to Tennessee, the mountains there. But I had to do program. I was offered to do programs for the YMCA of the Rockies in Estes Park. And so we went out a number of years ago and just traveling from Chicago, west through Iowa, west through Nebraska, and into Colorado was a magnificent road trip. Now, there's a lot of people say, boy, Iowa's boring and Nebraska's boring because it's flat and everything. Of course, I had this geologic mindset. And so I was always tuned into the different vegetation. For me, up north is when I start to see North American white pine all over the place. Okay. Because you don't see in Illinois, you don't have very much of the way of indigenous North American white pine. There is a place called White Pine State Park that is old growth forest. They're not as tall as you would find like up in the upper peninsula of Michigan at the Estevants or Hartwick Pines in the upper part of the lower peninsula, where you have these magnificent giants, or Cook Forest in Pennsylvania, these magnificent giants, giant trees that are not quite as big as the redwoods in California, but they're absolutely totally magnificent. That's when I know that I'm up north, when I see that very distinct silhouette of the pine trees that are up and mixing in with the deciduous trees. That's when I know that I'm going home back up north. So that's for me one of those touchstones.
Absolutely. I agree. You know, the white pines and the white birch as well.
Sure.
You know, mix it. And I think, it's hard to underestimate as well, you know, the significance of the white pine in Great Lakes region's history. And really the history of the United States for that matter.
Sure. I mean, it was the Great Lakes, of course, there I'm get on my Great Lakes soapbox again, but it was really the engine that developed. Once the Erie Canal was opened up in 1825, then there was, it accelerated the Western expansion into the heart of North America, both sides of the border. And much of that was driven by people finding new life out here, but also, and very good ground, development of the plow and John Deere and that type of thing, break up the prairie, but also the forests. Was it Walt Whitman said, may have been Henry Thoreau, said there was a time in colonial North America where a squirrel could climb a tree in Massachusetts and not touch the ground till they got to Western Minnesota. It's amazing. You know, that's, and that's what the forest was like. Primeval forest. Now there are still little packets of that around, and it's like when you go to Hartwick Pines or Cook Forest or the Shawnee National Forest down in southern Illinois, it's like stepping back in time. It's like putting your feet in the shoes of the pioneers who broke the prairie. Of course, I'm waxing ecstatic about a lot of areas beyond the Great Lakes, but, you know, the Flint Hills in Kansas are that way too. There you see the high plains. And western Nebraska, the high plains are magnificent in their own right. However, to get back to the Great Lakes, 20% of the entire fresh water on the surface of the earth is tied up in the Great Lakes. 20% of the entire, and 70% of the fresh water on the surface is tied up in the poles, ice. So it's like, let me expound on that a little bit. It's actually 6% of the total fresh water, but on Earth is tied up in the Great Lakes, to explain a little bit better. But 70% of all the freshwater surface on a surface freshwater on Earth is tied up in the poles. And so that leaves 30% left. And so of the remaining surface freshwater, 20% of what is remaining is in the Great Lakes region. And it is a huge responsibility, which to maintain that, to nurture it. And I think the songs and the history give us a good foundation for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree completely, right? I think that, again, it's really difficult to underestimate the importance of the Great Lakes. And I think that a lot of people, even that have lived in the region their entire life, don't really realize, how important it is and what the future is going to look like, right? Because when we talk about, you know, some of the major issues facing humanity today, climate change being first and foremost among those. Talk about not only migrations of people to, you know, these sort of climate havens, of which you mentioned Duluth earlier. I know that Duluth in recent years has taken some steps towards, sort of preparing themselves for an inevitable deluge of people that will eventually end up further north in the Upper Great Lakes region, not only because of warming temperatures, right, but also because of access to fresh water, right? I know some political pundits and war theorists have also speculated, right, that the next major war, or possibly even world war, will not be fought over oil, but water. So I think that, all that being said, you know, that the Great Lakes region will only continue to become more and more politically important, not only within our own country, but in the world. Would you
agree? I agree. And I remember, I'm a great one for maps. And I remember seeing when I was young and in college, maps of central Eurasian continent with the Caspian Sea and the Aral Sea and that area, Black Sea. And what was fascinating was how the Aral Sea was just completely going away. And of course, that's happening to the Great Salt Lake too. And it's basically, it was due to irrigation and irrigation is a beautiful thing. I mean, to be able to do on a continual basis agriculture and not be quite as tied to the mercy of the rains is a beautiful thing. And that was something that sustained indigenous peoples in the Southwest for a long time. And of course, all over the globe, but there again, you have to take a look at, should we be growing bluegrass in Arizona? I don't think so. When you go to New Mexico, and this is not to take the task to Arizonans, but When you go to New Mexico, some of the big palatial estates and everything in Arizona, or I mean, New Mexico, it's all desert landscaping, which isn't as, and I'm, it's a generalization on my part. So there is some grass, but it, mostly it is all the beauty of the desert is celebrated, as opposed to trying to bring the Midwest to the desert, which is what has happened down and around Phoenix and all that type of thing. And that's why there's quite a shortage. And, you know, with the, that's why the Colorado never makes it to the sea anymore. So, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, it reminds me of a chapter in Dan Egan's book, Death and Life of the Great Lakes, right? Where he talks about, I think there was some harebrained scheme back in the 70s to pipe Lake Superior water out to cattle ranches or something like that, or mining, some mines in Colorado or something. Yep. And it prompted the governors of most of the Great Lakes state and estates, as well as some politicians in Canada, to kind of form like a task force, which I think something similar actually still exists today.
It's called the Joint Commission on the Great Lakes. Yes.
Yeah.
And so therefore that can't happen right now.
Right.
As long as people follow laws. Just a little detail,
sure.
Not to get political here, but, you know, and so that's why it is. That's why we're not shipping the water down to Arizona. Although, you know, your heart goes out to the folks when they're in drought and that type of thing, or the way the extreme heat in the South this year. I mean, it was here in the Chicago area. We didn't have a lot of heat. Actually, it was pretty moderate. There was a few warm days, but kind of a typical summer. But boy, it went south, and it was, you know, devastating, the heat and the dryness. That's one of the things that the Great Lakes region provides, is a great source of fresh water, provided we take care of it. And also somewhat moderation in as far as temperatures are concerned. You know, the Great Lakes are bodies that affect weather, and so they're big enough so that they can affect weather. And so if you have a big snowpack north of Lake Superior, then the water levels are going to be up, they're going to be fine. If you don't have a lot of snowpack and the temperature is a little bit warmer, the lakes don't freeze over, the evaporation goes up. And that's when the lake levels go down. And I think right now, although in Illinois, it was a little bit dry and some of the rivers were down, it wasn't as bad as, you know, down south in Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Arizona. I remember reading an article recently about, I believe it was Phoenix, who said, I don't know if it's the entire city or certain areas that were earmarked for more development, but they said they're going to stop issuing new building permits because there just isn't any more water to sustain that population.
That's right. That's right. You know, and there might be ways of desalinization filtering, you know, the existing water. You know, that can, you know, help with that, but it's, you know, there's been a big rush, big population growth, and then small population growth, big population and small population growth due to climate in that region for hundreds of years. Mm. You know, you have different indigenous peoples. I know we're off the topic of the Great Lakes. Sorry about that, but, you're basically, you have to have the fresh water and the resources to sustain a population. And there's this back and forth that happened even through the indigenous peoples. Mm. When we think of the indigenous peoples, we think of, you know, the noble savage and all that, and how they're in tune with the land and stuff. Well, that's actually, they're human just like everybody else, and they make mistakes just like everybody else, or have, and throughout history. And so, it's our job to try and learn from those mistakes.
Yeah, so you talk about right, the ebb and flow of climate, and again, you know, climate change is an ongoing conversation. And I have been now for a number of years basically saying to anyone who will listen, basically talking about how I believe that the Great Lakes region is going to be of utmost importance moving forward for several reasons, right? One, we already talked about 20% of the world's, you know, fresh surface water. You know, the other is it's also one of the most biodiverse and agriculturally diverse places in the world, right? I believe it's Michigan is second only to California in the number of agricultural products that are produced on a commercial level. I think it's over 300. So I guess put another way to sort of bring it back full circle to your music, you talk a lot about history, right, in your music, but what do you feel is the future? I know that's a big question, but what do you think the future holds for the lakes and the region, and what do you see as some of the biggest threats and challenges to the region, but also do you see it as a bright future, or, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, of course. So what does the future hold as you see it for this region that you've clearly dedicated so much of your life to studying and being passionate about? From
my hope is that people will really fundamentally embrace their environment and enjoy it in a responsible way, that they will embrace each other also culturally, and not just pay lip service to it, but really see the humanity in all of us. And I think that's what these songs do, because there's not that much difference between, you know, a guy working in a steel mill and a gal working at a computer. We're all trying to do something to sustain ourselves, but also to make the world a better place. That's what I think. And business goes along with that in a way that can interface with government agencies, religious organizations, service organizations. And what I'm hoping is that we will find the humanity in each of us through songs, through art, through literature, and through labor work. You know, there's a lot of talk now about the labor movement and how it's ascendant. Just this morning, I mean, I was hearing about what's happening with the UAW and what has happened with the screenwriters and what is happening with what happened with the Teamsters and UPS, and how 70-some percent of the American people are siding with the average everyday worker now, a union worker. And I think that is where I see we can build on each other's positives, as opposed to focusing so much on what makes us different. And that can be done throughout the world, but it can be done in a fundamental way in the Great Lakes region.
That's great. Thank you. That you have a I would say an optimistic outlook. So I thank you for that perspective. It's refreshing. You're welcome. Okay, well, to wrap up here, I guess for our listeners, you know, it's my hope that this podcast will have a little something for everyone of interest, not only, you know, within the Great Lakes states, but also further afield outside of the Great Lakes, and maybe even for those, right? This is the power of the internet and Potentially, we could have people listening internationally from other countries. So I guess as a parting note here, what would you say to people who have never visited the Great Lakes? Why should they come visit? What might they find here of interest? Not only the place, but the people and the culture. If you could just have a little kind of soundbite and be the spokesman for Great Lakes tourism, why should people travel far and wide to come see what the Great Lakes are all about?
Throughout history, the Great Lakes has been a conduit for people traveling. Back before European contact, it was the freshwater highway for many peoples, correspondence between the different nations. I prefer to use that as opposed to tribes, whether they were from Lakota out in Lake Superior region or the Iroquois in the lower lakes, and many peoples in between. And then with European integration, you had the French come and the British, not as much in the way of the Spanish, although they kind of got up into the Mississippi River Valley and that type of thing, but they were pretty much in the South, whereas the French and the English, you know, came into North America. And of course, before even the French and the English, the Dutch. And so what you have is an area that is steeped in cosmopolitan tradition. It was always a crossroads and will always remain a crossroads. And it's a fascinating place where you can get on a boat in Chicago and go up to Duluth and then come down to Toronto. And even if you get up beyond down the St. Lawrence and Montreal and Quebec City, it is a area that is steeped in a cosmopolitan ethos that celebrates many, many, many cultures and much geographical and horticultural diversity. And it's just, it's my backyard. Come visit.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, as you're talking about the cosmopolitanism of the Great Lakes region, it's funny, it kind of reminded me of this, you know, sort of dichotomy that we hear, you know, people talk about in the media and things, and it's been sort of weaponized even by certain politicians, this idea of, right, the coasts and the people who live in the coastal regions and the so-called flyover states, right, of the Midwest. But you point out something that is really important, right, is that a lot of people don't realize is that, right, we don't just have two coasts. In fact, you know, some people refer to coastal Great Lakes as the third coast. I think there's even maybe a brewery or something of that
name. Yes, there is.
You know, just something, just food for thought, right? I think a lot of people sort of gloss over, don't quite understand the extent to which the Great Lakes region is and has been for a long, long time. Even, you know, pre-arrival of the European settlers, a cosmopolitan place, as you mentioned. Yes. You know, the native peoples came from far and wide to trade here and to, right, and add, you know, holy or sacred sites in and, sure, around the region, and came to trade and things like that and party and, sure, like that. So yeah, it's at its very core, it's nature. It's a place of travelers, a cosmopolitan place. And the other thing is, also put quite simply, upper Midwestern people are friendly. We're a friendly, sure, bunch, and we are generally pretty welcoming to outsiders and love to, as people from listening might be able to tell, we're passionate about our home, and we love,
that's
to,
true,
share with others.
You sure are. So it's it's a real privilege to be able to do this podcast, and thank you very much for all your hard work and putting this together, because we're all pulling in the same direction, and that's to make people more aware of their Great Lakes heritage, and it extends well beyond just the border states of the Great Lakes.
Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Great Lakes podcast. Tune in next time for more of the history, culture, outdoor life, and people of the Great Lakes region. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Caleb Ford, signing off from the shores of the mighty Lake Superior in Michigan's beautiful Upper Peninsula. Until next time, everybody.
Down below the quarter deck, old men man the fishing nets. While up on the windy bridge, young men cursing to the wind. Up and down the Windsor streets, the wise mothers lie awake. They pray Our Lady of the Lake will bring them home again. Michigan, Father Superior, coming down from Mackinac and Sault Ste. Marie.